Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Gareth Coker, and here we are again. It's great to have a chance to talk with you, this time about your soundtrack for Ark Survival Evolved.
Yep, I think it's the third time this year. I hope you're not getting sick of me.
Not at all. Because every single one of these projects has just been so different on so many different levels. And honestly, listening to your music for Ark, I feel like I've gone 18 rounds with a pro boxer because it's just so intense. It's really amazing. I would love to know what sort of mindset you had to get into to write this incredible music.
Well, first of all, you kind of start, you're always looking for a visual, just a concept, an idea. The first thing I wrote was the main theme for the game. That was actually my pitch. And my pitch ended up being what is in the game today as the main theme, which is pretty cool. But what they wanted is an epic adventuring feel, but they didn't want it to sound like Jurassic Park. And there's a little, and they mentioned that there was a little bit of a science fiction element in the game, which becomes far more prevalent towards the end of the game. So they wanted all of that in one epic piece of music. And the other thing they wanted is they wanted a strong theme. They were absolutely, they emphatically said that they wanted a strong theme. So I wrote the main theme first, and that was the birth of the rest of the score. Now, as for the scale which you mentioned, it is a pretty intense score. That said, I will qualify it by saying that what you hear on the soundtrack is the most intense version of each piece that plays in the game. So each area of the game, like the beach, the mountain, the jungles, they have a full mix, and then they have a light mix, which is just a stripped down version of the same piece of music. None of the light mixes made it onto the soundtrack because I didn't find them as compelling pieces of music to put on a soundtrack length album. So that's why you've got the full intense heavy versions of the music, and the music itself is supposed to represent one survival. You're stuck on an island and you've just got to fend for yourself. On this island are dinosaurs and all kinds of creatures, and while you're dealing with them and trying to build your own base to survive, you've also potentially got to deal with other humans who are out to get you as well. So basically everyone is out to get you, but if you're lucky, you can band up with other humans and tame some of these wild creatures and use them to cause your own path of destruction. Really, the scope of the game, if you want to, you can be playing it by yourself and you'll never hear any combat music whatsoever. On the other end of the scale, which is where we have pushed the score, you can have the most epic battles with hundreds of dinosaurs fighting each other at the same time. So that's how the scope of the score came to be.
Wow, it's just massive. Yeah, and as you mentioned, it's a game that you can really get lost in. And one of the things that you mentioned that you've touched on is that this game was an early access game, which meant that mm-hmm. it was kind of being developed in front of a huge audience. And your part of it was that you had to write the music in that same way. So, I mean, what was that experience like? Like writing with millions of people watching and listening?
It's one of the most unique phenomenons I've experienced. I don't think I'll go through anything similar again for quite a while. So basically, I'll compare it to a film. So when you're doing a film, you might be working with a director who has placed some temp music in the film and they really like that temp music and want you to do a good job of like copying it. That's pretty common in the film industry. Now, with this, the temp music is my own music because it's the digital mockup. But what you have is, instead of a director falling in love with the music, you have the audience falling in love with your music, so you can't really change it without having a knock-on effect or a ripple effect through the audience. Now, you mentioned the size of Ark's audience. The game, through Early Access, has shipped over 10 million units. Like, 10 million people have bought it in Early Access. So that's potentially, every time you make a change, you are affecting 10 million people in real time. Now, I'll just use the main theme as an example, because the main theme was the first piece of music to go into the game, and the first thing that people heard because it was in the launch trailer. Now, I fiddled around with the main theme several times over the course of the 2 years, and I remember, I think it was the third time I changed it, I did a significantly different mix, and it was a little bit quieter, And oh my goodness, the comments on the forums, you've ruined the music, it's terrible, I hate this new direction. I'm like, wow, okay. So I just realized that, like, it's not that the music was bad, it's not even that the music had changed, but because people had associated a positive experience of their time with Ark with a piece of music, it's not that you're changing the music, it's that you're changing their memories. Thus, the nostalgia element has a really, like, strong part to play in early access, assuming your title is successful. So, with that, the final version of the main theme, which we did with the live orchestra, it is a live orchestra, but it still retains some of the aesthetic elements of the very first mock-up that I did. And I hope that is, like, a bridge between what I wanted and a bridge between what the players wanted. Hindsight, I would handle early access a little bit differently. One of the other mistakes, and I know it's a mistake now, that was made is at the beginning we only had two pieces of combat music in the game, one for fighting at daytime and one for fighting at nighttime. Regardless of where you were on the island, whether you were on the beach or whether you were on the mountain or whether you were in the jungle or in the cave or wherever. Now, the music in the final release has music for all, separate music and a full mix and a light mix for all of the different locations. So it's much more varied. But again, the problem was is that when we put the mock-ups of all of these different tracks for the different locations in, people had become so used to hearing the day and nighttime music that it took a while to transition over. I think the new solution is better, but you've kind of got to ride out the transition. So that's like two examples that with the main theme and all of the combat music, where, like, working within early access, it can be a little bit confining, but on the other hand, you do get real-time feedback from the player community, so you do get a chance to fix things as well. So there's a little bit of give and take. I think the only thing I would change really is at the beginning of the game, I would have had way more combat music than just the day and night music, or I would have tried to have had some basic combat music for every single location in the game rather than just the two core tracks. But you know, that's the nature of early access. It's, you kind of learn things as you go. And also, without early access, I don't think we'd have been in a position to do the recording that we did. So there's give and take on both sides.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know of another group of music lovers that are as passionate as game players. And I think part of it's because they spend so many hours listening to the music. I mean, way more than people would listen to, you know, top 40 or even classical music. And so they really get into it. They're very, you know, sort of territorial about it sometimes. So,
I mean, some of the top players in ARK have been playing for over 3,000 hours. I think the top hour ranking is like, that I've seen, someone's played it for like 5,000 hours. So that's a really long time.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that recording because,
yeah.
I mean, it just is sort of like indicative of the epic scale of the whole process. Because, first of all, you got to go to Abbey Road Studios, which must have been just the most amazing experience.
Yeah, so back in, it was at GDC, actually, the Game Developers Conference. We kind of met up there briefly, myself and Studio Wildcard, and we knew that the end was in sight. And I'd written a lot of music for the game, and we just put in all the new combat music. And I was like, "So, do you guys want to do a live recording?" And they're like, "Yeah, let's talk about it when we get back." And they said, "You know, let's gather some quotes and look at the different locations." And you know, I gave them like my first and second and third choice, my first choice being to record it in London. And I honestly wasn't sure if they would go for it, but they just took one look at the figure and they're like, yeah, why not? The way I sold it to them was that, you know, it's a massive game. Abbey Road Studio One is the biggest purpose-built recording room in the world. So you just needed a massive room to be able to take all of the sound. And then instead of just a standard, you know, 70-piece symphony orchestra, I got 93 players instead. So honestly, we probably could have done it with less, but you know, part of me wanted to push it to 100 just so I could say I've done one with an 100-piece orchestra. But maybe I can save that one for the future. But really, it was, we needed more strings to balance out the massive brass section. So the bulk of those 93 players are the 60-piece string section. Because with the force we had in the brass, we just needed to balance it out a little bit, and I think we got the lineup right. It's also really quite a bassy soundtrack. So, you know, instead of like three trombones, we have like four trombones and two of them are bass trombones, and one of them is even a contrabass trombone, which is a fabulous instrument because it can, I think its lowest note can actually go lower than the piano. But only by like one like step, but it is possible. You can get like that low. So, and then we had contrabassoon and bass clarinet like together, and that combination is also a wicked awesome sound for doing epic dinosaur music. So I remember the first time walking out into Abbey Road Studios just before we're about to press record. And for the first time, and I'm like, what am I doing here? It was the first time, I'm pretty confident and self-assured, but this was the first time I'd really suffered from any kind of imposter syndrome. Because I'm about to stand on the podium, and I'm thinking, wow, Lord of the Rings was recorded here, Harry Potter was recorded here, some Star Wars films were recorded here, Iron Man 3 was recorded here like a couple of years ago, and then in the booth my engineer is Simon Rhodes, who's recorded a lot of James Horner's music, including Avatar, and then in front of me is the Philharmonia Orchestra, who are one of the best orchestras in London, in Europe, possibly the world, and I'm like, hey, they're here because of me.
Wow.
I mean, not because of me, but because of Wildcard as well. You know, but we all kind of like rally towards doing going to London. And I was like, I mean it was a pretty surreal moment. So I had to like take a deep breath before my opening sentences. I'm not usually nervous, but that was one like very nerve-wracking moment. But after the introduction, we then hear take one of the main theme, and I'm like, ah, everything's going to be fine. It had the huge sound that I expected and more. And I think that comes across on the album too.
Well, it does. And one of the things that you mentioned in the really cool video that's out and around that I'm going to include on the website because it's so great, is that that space, Studio One, not only has room for all those players, but it has space around them. So they don't sound like they're crammed into a little closet. So that makes a huge difference too.
It's funny, like, I remember going in, I was like, wow, we're 93 players, we could easily fit another 40 in here and it wouldn't be crowded. And I think the biggest number of people that's been in there is about 200 when John Williams did the Phantom Menace. I think they had about 90 players and then they had an 110-piece choir. So that must have been fun. But yeah, it wasn't... It really helped give a sense of space to the music, and with music that's heavy, that is that heavy for that long, you kind of need that amount of air. I think the most impressive thing is the ceiling. It just seems to go on forever and ever and ever. It's which really helps the sound reverberate in a friendly way around the room.
Yeah, well, this may get into the weeds a little bit too much, but I'm just wondering, with the sound engineer, how much like massaging did he have to do with the sound of the orchestra? Because it's a pretty natural sound, just the way it is on the soundtrack.
My mix engineer, Steve Kempster, he mixes all my stuff since Ori and the Blind Forest, and he's done all the Minecraft stuff. And actually, it's funny that he'll be really happy that you said it's a natural sound, because actually, quite a lot of the time, we're taking the massive orchestra and occasionally mixing them with the digital orchestra as well, just to reinforce it even more. It's about an 80% 20% ratio, but sometimes it helps give it that little bit extra oomph. But I think one of the reasons that you might think it sounds natural is we didn't, for almost all of the tracks, we didn't split the strings and brass. What a lot of soundtracks do nowadays is they record the strings and woodwind on one pass, and then they record the brass on a separate pass, and then they put the two together in post-production. For almost all of the tracks, we recorded everything at the same time. Now, if you're going to do that, you better make sure your orchestration is on point, because it requires everything to be balanced properly. Fortunately, that seemed to work out. But let's take the Overseer track, for example. That is take two, and it was all recorded in the room at the same time. And it just worked. So when that happens and the orchestra is all playing together, not much massaging is actually required. So that's kind of what you're... the ultimate goal of what you're looking for. You get a little bit less control in post-production because you haven't recorded the section separately, but you get a more natural, refined sound, and I think you get a better performance as well, because the players enjoy playing together the whole time.
Well, sure, and they probably have this feel, they start out knowing that they're going to get to the end, so it's almost like playing a piece of, you know, classical music or something else, where it's not just bits and pieces, it's like the whole thing right straight through. So
yep exactly.
Yeah, and that Overseer track, oh my gosh, that's the final boss, right? And
yes,
you mentioned that it's at 200 beats per minute, and I actually had to check my metronome to see if it went that fast, because that's just screaming fast. So did the orchestra feel like they were battling the final boss as they were playing it?
Well, it's funny. The 200 beats per minute part definitely refers to the part of the music that's in 5/4, which is about 60% of the track, because the opening's in 4/4. So it kind of switches between 200 beats per minute and 100 beats per minute, depending on the overall feel. But I remember stepping out in front of the orchestra, and I was like, hey guys, this is what I think is the most difficult piece of music on the soundtrack. And this was day three, so they were kind of used to the score at this point. They'd already had 2.5 days of playing really crazy epic music. So they were like, oh, okay, a new challenge awaits us. And I think, because it was the first time I'd highlighted that a piece was going to be difficult, they responded in a way, it kind of, I don't want to say woke them up, but it kind of awoke their extra senses, basically. They're like, okay, he's challenged us, let's respond to the challenge. And I think they were just a little bit more switched on because I'd come out and addressed them and told them that it was like one of the end game pieces of music, and as a result, what you hear on the album is take two. So we did one take for the sight reading and another take for performance, and I was like, well, we're done. Good job, guys. We spent about, I think it was done in like 12 minutes. Sometimes funny things like that happen. Like the piece that you think is going to be easy to record ends up taking the most time, and conversely, the piece that you think is going to be, you know, the most difficult ends up taking the least time. There's a lot of psychology that happens during a recording session. You kind of have to get a beat on how the musicians are feeling, and that's where my conductor Alex Rudd comes into play. He is fantastic at reading the mood of the room, at telling when the players are tired or when they need need a break, or when to like change up the mood and maybe like choose a faster, jauntier piece instead of another slow, plodding, epic, blockbustery piece. So that's a really important part of the process that I don't think gets talked about very much. Is you don't want someone boring standing in front of you for 3 days. You want someone engaging and lively, and that's what Alex does. It's what he does much better than I could, because I'm kind of playing the bad cop and looking for problems, and he can play the good cop and relay it into to the musicians in a way that makes them feel good, and then ultimately makes them respond better to the music, which ultimately leads to a better performance. That chemistry is one thing I think that is really, really important when putting together a recording, because I think it can be felt on the final soundtrack.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned that you were there for 3 days. The recordings took 3 days, and probably that was a good thing, because I'm sure they had to like go rest and recover in between the sessions.
Well, they do get a 10-minute break every hour, so that helps break things up, or a 15-minute break, or is it a 20-minute break? They get enough break time, basically. But actually, I was worried about the stamina for the brass, and they just kept on going and going and going. It was just unbelievable. I think one of the things that may help is that even though the brass is playing really loud and quite forcefully, they're not doing it for the duration of all of the tracks. So they do get rest time even during each piece of music. The strings, it's just a workout for them. I think most of all it was a workout for the bassist, because they're providing the foundation most of the time. And those instruments are just really, really, really big. And if you've got a lot of moving lines, which in Arc there is, it can end up being quite a workout. The principal bassist, Tim Gibbs, he like approached me during a break, and he was like, "Yeah, I get that this is an action score, but man, you need to give us a break sometimes, or at least give us the melody to make up for all the low bass stuff that we're doing." And so I actually changed a part in the Overseer track to give the basses a melody just for a brief moment, just to give them a brief moment of joy. But most of the basses and the cellos, it's quite a workout, just because they're dealing with bigger instruments, so it requires more physical energy to play them. Whereas obviously a violin or a viola is not as heavy. Even though they might be playing more notes, it's less physical work for them. That said, they recorded 130 minutes of music in total in 3 days. That's a lot of music to record in 3 days, especially in this style. So I think it was probably one of the heavier workouts they've had, but I never noticed any tiredness, which either means they did a good job of hiding it, or they just weren't tired and they have great stamina.
Well, maybe they were just so pumped up by the music too. I mean, that could be a thing. And then probably when they went off to play some Mahler or Bruckner, it felt like a vacation for them.
Right. I think that's exactly what they'd actually come back from a tour of Japan, and then like 3 days later they were coming to play Arc. Some of them might have still been jet lagged, so I really don't know like how they were able to get up for it. But I guess that's the art of being in a professional orchestra. You kind of have to turn up and bring your A game, and that's exactly what they did.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And let's kind of revisit. You mentioned that there are a lot of different geographical areas in this game.
Yes.
And so that gave you, it sounds like, a lot of ideas for how to craft the music for each one of the sections. There are, you know, swamps and huge mountains and polar areas. And so how did you kind of make your music a good fit with all those different areas?
You're kind of looking for visual clues within the game. So like, what does the environment look like? I'm a very visual person. I respond well to seeing visuals. So that's what inspires me the most. And it's really a case of just finding the right area to write in. So for example, for the swamps, I'm not doing too much high fast stuff. It's a little bit of a slower, trudgier pace. Whereas when we get to the mountain music, like there's a track on there, I think it's called Scaling the Island's Peaks. It's a little bit more adventurous, because it does take quite a lot of work to get up to the mountain. And also, like, the mountain is one of those risk-reward places as a player. Like, it's difficult to get up there, but if you get up there, some of the best resources on the island await you. So it can be like a real adventure getting up there.
Thank you.
mountain music it just has like more of a sense of adventure, whereas the swamps, they're a little bit safer, but like it's the swamp, so heat is an issue and movement is an issue. The beaches, on the other hand, are the safest place in the game. So track 2 on the album, which is the Southern Islets, that is battle music, but if you listen to it, it's a little bit more upbeat and jaunty, because the beaches are in general way less dangerous. So, to answer your question, the way I decided how to write for each section was defined either visually or how dangerous it is for the player to be in this location. So, the more dangerous, the more intense the music. This is further exemplified by the boss tracks, which I've mentioned the Overseer already, but there's three other bosses. The dragon, the broodmother, and the megapithecus. Now, the dragon is a dragon. the broodmother is a giant spider, and the megapithecus is a giant gorilla ape thing. So those three monsters kind of have their own style. I definitely looked towards the Planet of the Apes soundtrack, for example, for the megapithecus. The broodmother kind of has a bunch of creepy strings going on, and it's just there's a lot of pitch bending in the strings as well, which is just generally a creepy sound, and I think that matches the giant spider well. And then the dragon, I'll admit it. It's pretty safe dragon music. It's just pretty epic, and it has a strong melody. But it also has a soaring element as well. The way I tend to approach most of my projects actually is define the visuals, and then like what is the player supposed to be feeling at this point in the game. And I think if I can get those two things right, I'm usually like 95% of the way there.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you got so much direction and so much information and builds of the game from the developers that, I mean, it almost sounds like you were there.
Well, here's the thing. You mentioned that it's not even just builds from the developer. Remember, it's in early access. I can just go online and watch. Because people are streaming the game all of the time. Like, Ark was the number one streamed game on Twitch for a long time, and it's still in Steam charts. It's one of the top 10 played games on Steam. Like, if I check right now, there's probably 60,000 to 70,000 people playing it right now, and that's just on Steam. That's not including Xbox or PlayStation, where there's going to be even more playing. So all of these people are potentially broadcasting their game, so I can just jump in and watch, and that gives me one that saves time on my part, because Ark is such a huge game, it would be impossible to test every scenario. So I can just like kind of jump in to Twitch, or I can like go onto YouTube and do a search for like certain locations of the game to see like what players are experiencing, and then I can take all of that information, and then it helps inform what music I'm going to write next or how I'm going to improve existing music. It's one of the advantages of early access. People, and the fact that we live in the 21st century and Twitch and YouTube are such a huge thing right now. We have all of this information and video that we can use to make our work better.
Yeah, which is incredible. And did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams that you'd have like 10 million people listening to your music? That's got to be an amazing feeling.
It's pretty cool. I didn't realize like how, I don't think anyone realized quite how big the game would become. Like, it definitely helped. Like, the initial launch trailer definitely sold the Adventures with Dinosaurs feel quite well. And now the game has this cool science fiction element that has been added in over the years, which was always planned, but it wasn't there on the initial release. So now not only do we have dinosaurs, we get to do science fiction as well, and that's kind of brought in a whole new audience that seems to love the game as well. And one, I think, important thing to remember is that 3 out of 4 early access games never make it to release. So for a game this big, it would have been very easy to stay in early access and just keep on adding features. But the fact that they were able to kind of stick to their roadmap, although I think they were delayed significantly, but they were able to get it across the finishing line, it now gives them like impetus to move forward and good. I learned a lot during early access. Goodness knows what the development team learned during early access, because like the amount of information they have is extraordinary. So there's 2 more expansions coming, which will of course require music, and I'm sure they'll take the lessons learned from developing the core game and put them into the expansions. And who knows what the future brings for Ark and Studio Wildcard. But this whole early access thing is so unique, and it's still fairly new, that it's kind of cool to see, to first of all be on a project that gets over the finishing line, but also to be on a project that clearly like had a far and wide reach, which you never really know when you start the project, like how popular is it going to be. You obviously hope it's going to be popular, but then when it actually happens, it's really awesome and fun to watch.
Yeah, I bet. And to be part of it as it's being developed, I mean, I know you've done that before with your studios, but it's always been, you know, behind the scenes, and then there's the game all done and released. So to be part of this kind of long-term journey in public under scrutiny is a really amazing thing, as you've said. And so when we talked earlier about your music for The Unspoken, you mentioned that one of the things you had learned from working on that music is that you don't have to include massive, massive forces for an epic sound, and yet here you did. But were there any things that you learned writing the music for Ark that now you'll be able to take forward for your other soundtracks?
I think one of the things I learned is that once I added the live orchestra into the mix, it took away the need for a lot of percussion. Like, I know there's a lot of percussion in the soundtrack, But you should have heard it, the amount of percussion that was in the mock-ups before the sound, before we recorded the soundtrack, there was even more. I think one of the things that percussion does when you're writing the digital versions of the piece is it can add energy when energy doesn't exist in the orchestral parts, because computers can only emulate an orchestra up to a point. Now, when we added the real players, and, you know, 93 of them, there was less of a need to have percussion in the music, because the energy was provided by the kinetic movement of the strings. Like, it's not just the fact that the violins are playing fast notes, it's the fact that a bow is hitting a string, and a bow is moving very fast. There's a lot of air moving, there's a lot of energy happening, and that's the kind of thing that you can't really do digitally. So now that I know that, moving forward, I'll try and do a better job on my mock-ups and being less reliant on percussion. But I think rather than use percussion as a crutch, I would like to use it more as a feature in future scores. I think the other thing I learned is always, if you're working in early access, like, pay attention to your audience, but also stick to your creative vision. Like, it can be very easy to be influenced by comments on forums, on Twitter, on YouTube, etc., etc. But at the end of the day, I think I would always say to, like, anyone who's working in early access games, and there's a lot of them now, because it is a viable business model. If you're working in early access, try to stick to your creative vision as much as you possibly can. You've got to listen to your community to a point, but also you kind of got to set out to make the game that you want to make. And I was bent to a certain degree, but I didn't break in terms of, like, my creative vision for the game, and the same for Wildcard. So yeah, I hope that's a good answer for, like, things I learned.
It's always interesting to hear about your process, because I know you think so deeply about these things and you really break it down to a granular level, and so to find out, you know, how the wheels are turning, I think, is really, really fascinating. And the end result is just spectacular. And Gareth, as always, it's been so much fun to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.